radio broadcast of the 7th of February 1952, before pausing and appearing to stumble.
"I suppose no minister." "I am sure no minister. Saw so much of the king during the war as I did."
In fact, Churchill's human hesitation only added to the strength of his heartfelt tribute to the dead monarch and his emotional evocation of the new Elizabethan age. His speech, which he entitled "For Valour," the motto of the Victoria Cross, Britain's highest award for bravery, proved a triumph, ranking alongside the great perorations with which he had rallied the country during the darkest days of the Second World War. The final scenes of Hyde Park Corner depict Churchill's critics, Eden and Robert Bobberty Cecil, the 5th Marquess of Salisbury and leader of the House of Lords, along with Clement Attlee, the former Labour Prime Minister and leader of the opposition, as they digest the quivering brilliance of the Prime Minister's oratory. Churchill was secure as the leader of Elizabeth II's first government, for the time being at least, as he conjured up the memory of the father that she and the nation had lost.
"During these last months," he declaimed into the microphone, "the king walked with death as if death were a companion, an acquaintance whom he recognized and did not fear. In the end, death came as a friend. And after a happy day of sunshine and sport, and after good night to those who loved him best, he fell asleep as every man or woman who strives to fear God and nothing else in the world may hope to do. My friends, no minister. I suppose no minister. I am sure no minister. Saw so much of the king during the war as I did. I made certain he was kept informed of every secret matter, and the care and thoroughness with which he mastered the immense daily flow of state papers made a deep mark on my mind. For 15 years, George VI was king. Never at any moment, in all the perplexities at home and abroad, in public or in private, did he fail in his duties. Well does he deserve the farewell salute of all his governments and peoples. It is at this time that our compassion and sympathy go out to his consort and widow,
Queen Elizabeth, now the Queen Mother.
That valiant woman, with famous blood of Scotland in her veins, who sustained King George through all his toils and problems, and brought up with their charm and beauty the two daughters who mourn their father today. May she be granted strength to bear her sorrow. Now I must leave the treasures of the past and turn to the future. Famous have been the reigns of our queens. Some of the greatest periods in our history have unfolded under their scepter. Now that we have the second, Queen Elizabeth, also ascending the throne in her 26th year, our thoughts are carried back nearly 400 years to the magnificent figure who presided over, and in many ways embodied and inspired, the grandeur and genius of the Elizabethan age. Queen Elizabeth II, like her predecessor, did not pass her childhood in any certain expectation of the crown. But already we know her well, and we understand why her gifts, and those of her husband, the Duke of Edinburgh, have stirred the only part of our Commonwealth she has yet been able to visit. She has already been acclaimed as Queen of Canada. We make our acclaim too. And tomorrow the proclamation of her sovereignty will command the loyalty of her native land and of all other parts of the British Commonwealth and Empire. I, whose youth was passed in the august, unchallenged and tranquil glories of the Victorian era, may well feel a thrill in invoking once more the prayer and the anthem, "God Save the Queen."
Martin Charteris, 1913 to 1999, played by Harry Haddon Patton. The wry and quizzical Martin Charteris saw the function of the monarchy as fun, to unroll the carpet of national happiness, and the former Lieutenant Colonel, King's Royal Rifle Corps, brought the same sense of sprightly joy to his work as private secretary to Elizabeth II, both as Princess, 1950 to 1952, and Queen, 1972 to 1977, with a 20-year stint in between as loyal subordinate to Tommy Lascelles and Michael Adeen. "I simply fell in love with her when I met her," he later confessed. "She was so young, beautiful, dutiful, the most impressive of women." The royal speeches became more humorous the day Charteris took over, with the new speechwriter displaying the gift of putting his mistress's thoughts into words. That is what made the post-retirement interview he gave to The Spectator so fascinating. In it, he called Prince Charles, whiny, Princess Margaret, the wicked fairy, the Queen Mother, a bit of an ostrich, and Sarah Ferguson, vulgar, vulgar, vulgar. Soon after the interview appeared, both the Queen and the Queen Mother invited dear Martin to lunch. Tobacco. The Fatal Royal Curse. Stricken by lung cancer, King George VI was the fourth British monarch of the 20th century to die of smoking-related causes. His great-grandfather, Bertie, King Edward VII, was a passionate devotee of tobacco, doing much as Prince of Wales to popularise the smoking of cigars and helping to endorse the remark of his acquaintance, the playwright Edward Bulwer-Lytton, "A good cigar is as great a comfort to a man as a good cry is to a woman." In 1878, the Prince, who smoked 12 large cigars and 20 cigarettes a day, gave the London tobacconists Benson and Hedges their first royal warrant. His mother, Queen Victoria, disapproved greatly. Throughout her long reign, cigars, pipes and cigarettes were strictly banned at court, so it was with unabashed delight at the end of dinner on the evening following his mother's death on the 22nd of January 1901 that Bertie declared, "Gentlemen, you may smoke." Aged 59 when he came to the throne, the massively overweight Edward VII was dogged by ill health, suffering from emphysema, chronic bronchitis, and a series of heart attacks, finally dying of pneumonia in 1911 at the age of 69. His less flamboyant son, King George V, shared his father's fondness for cigarettes and was often taken for the bearded sailor depicted on the packets of Players' navy-cut cigarettes. Suffering for much of his life from bronchitis and numerous lung problems, he died in January 1936 of a viral respiratory infection, aged 68. Edward VIII, George V's eldest son and short-lived successor, who abdicated in December 1936, was seldom pictured without a cigarette dangling elegantly from his lips or fingers. As Duke of Windsor, he resisted the efforts of advertising companies who wanted him to endorse their products, but as governor of the Bahamas in the Second World War, he did not stand in the way of his wife, who lent her name to a promotion campaign by Chesterfield Cigarettes. "Our records show," wrote the Duchess of Windsor from the United Services canteen in Nassau in 1943, "that day in and day out, smokers show a preference for Chesterfield over all other brands by a margin of 4-1. The American-born Duchess, explained Chesterfield, was working hard at the Nassau canteen to entertain both American and Allied troops. "She takes an active part in making her service guests feel at home. She cooks eggs and bacon, carries trays and hands out cigarettes." The Duke of Windsor died of throat cancer at the Villa Windsor outside Paris in 1972, with the Duchess following him 14 years later, having suffered from poor blood circulation, dementia, and eventually loss of speech. George V's widow, Queen Mary, an inveterate smoker, died of lung cancer in 1953 at the age of 85, and Princess Margaret, who smoked 30 cigarettes a day for many years and suffered from migraines, laryngitis, bronchitis, hepatitis, and pneumonia, died of a heart attack aged 71. Contemplating this sorry medical record, Prince Charles, a resolute non-smoker, is thought to have been behind the removal in the 1990s of the royal warrant from Gallagher, the 20th century producers of Benson & Hedges, Silkcut, Kensitas, Senior Service and other brands. At her son's suggestion, Queen Elizabeth II cancelled the supply of all smoking products to the royal households. So in the year 2000, after 122 years, the royal coat of arms finally disappeared from the packets of any British tobacco, cigars or cigarettes. Queen Alexandrina, King David and two King Alberts. Britain's monarchs, who might have been. Elizabeth II's decision to take her own name for her title, her so-called regnal name, was quite unusual in the modern history of the British monarchy. Her great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria, 1837 to 1901, was christened Alexandrina Victoria, after her godfather, Tsar Alexander I, and her mother, Marie-Louise Victoire. She was known to her family as Drina in her early childhood, and the accession documents prepared on the first day of her reign proclaimed her as Queen Alexandrina Victoria. But the new monarch insisted on Victoria alone because she had developed a strong personal fondness for the second name, a choice in which she had been encouraged by her uncle and predecessor, King William IV, the Sailor King. William thought the Navy would like it. Sailors would tattoo Victoria's face and name on their arms, he suggested, imagining that their queen had been named after Nelson's famous flagship, HMS Victory. Elizabeth's great-grandfather, King Edward VII, 1901 to 1911, was named after his high-minded but disapproving father, Albert, the Prince Consort. It was as a signal of his respect as a son, the new king suggested to his accession council in 1901 that the name of Albert the Good should henceforward be allowed to stand alone. But modern biographers of the fun-loving monarch have suggested quite the opposite, that Bertie could not wait to step clear of the father who had never found him good enough. Elizabeth's grandfather, George V, 1911 to 1936, was unique among the Queen's modern predecessors in choosing to reign under the first name by which his family called him as a child. Edward VIII, 1936, was baptised Edward Albert Christian George Andrew Patrick David, the last four of his names being those of the patron saints of England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales. His parents chose to call him David, in fanciful reference, perhaps, to the fact that he would become Prince of Wales. He took the trouble to learn a little Welsh when he was invested as Prince of Wales in 1911, but as both Prince and King, David took the more historic name of Edward. Elizabeth's father, George VI, 1936 to 1952, previously Prince Albert, Duke of York, was known to his family as Bertie, like his grandfather Edward VII. But when the time came to choose his regnal name in the troubled aftermath of the abdication, it was considered wise to emphasise continuity with his popular and solid father and founder of the House of Windsor, King George V. It is generally assumed that Queen Elizabeth II's successor, christened Charles Philip Arthur George, will, in due course, be proclaimed His Majesty King Charles III. But it is not impossible that he might choose to pay tribute to his grandfather and to his great-grandfather by adopting the regnal name of King George VII, with Philip and Arthur as two other respectable options. Chapter 3. Windsor. Birth of a Dynasty. When Britain's Queen Victoria married Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha on the 10th of February 1840, Saxe-Coburg-Gotha replaced Hanover as the name of the British royal family. The name change was automatic. Its most immediate effect was that Britain's queen and her future children could now proudly bear the family name of the man she loved. And in 1947, Philip Mountbatten assumed the same would happen when he and Elizabeth Windsor married. The Lord Chancellor of the time, Lord Jowett, agreed. He examined the proclamation that had changed the royal family's name to Windsor in 1917 and declared that it only applied to male heirs. The rubric did not mention female descendants, so, following the pattern set by Queen Victoria, the princess and her issue should now take the name of her husband. For the 5 remaining years of George VI's reign, the young couple, plus their children when they arrived, were duly referred to as the Mountbattens, and the former Elizabeth Windsor was happy and proud to be known as Elizabeth Mountbatten. This remained the case after the princess succeeded her father in February 1952. It is not always realized that Queen Elizabeth II came to the throne as Elizabeth Mountbatten, and that for 8 weeks it was quite true to say, as Lord Louis Mountbatten proudly boasted one night over dinner at Broadlands, that the House of Mountbatten now reigned. But as episode 3 of The Crown reveals, that boast provoked a bitter backlash from Queen Mary and Winston Churchill. When the arguments were over, the reigning House of Mountbatten was no more, and Queen Elizabeth II was a Windsor again, with the old name proving more powerful than people expected. Windsor was not just any family surname or title. It was a made-for-purpose brand identity that had been created by history, and by Elizabeth's beloved grandparents, King George V and Queen Mary, one of whom remained alive in 1952 to defend what she had helped to fashion 35 years earlier. Windsor had, at the outset, been the product of war, the Great War of 1914, whose official declaration George V, aged 49, had to sign on the 28th of July 1914. "It is a terrible catastrophe," the king noted in his diary that night, "but it is not our fault." He and his wife threw themselves immediately into war work, with the king travelling to France that November to visit the troops. "I cannot share your hardships," he told them, "but my heart is with you every hour of the day." Queen Mary, meanwhile, vigorously encouraged voluntary sewing and knitting campaigns, only to discover that she was provoking unemployment. Her prolific consignments of free socks and shirts led to women getting dismissed from mills and clothing factories. Perplexed, she turned for advice to a prominent trades unionist, Mary MacArthur, inviting her to Buckingham Palace, to the horror of her ladies-in-waiting, for a meeting that proved to be the first of many. "The Queen does understand and grasp the whole situation from a trade union point of view," MacArthur reported back to her colleagues. "I positively lectured the Queen on the inequality of the classes, the injustice of it. Here is someone who can help and means to help." Queen Mary's willingness to embrace the radical stemmed from the misfortunes of her youth. Her parents, Prince Francis and Princess Mary of Teck, were the laughingstock of the Victorian royal family, literally outcasts because they were driven abroad to flee their debtors, living in Short Street, as their industrious eldest daughter would put it in later life. Born in 1867 and christened May, the teenage princess took advantage of her parents' exile in Florence in the 1880s to add Italian to the English, French, and German that she already spoke. When her parents came back to England, May expanded her studies to include history and the social problems of an industrial society, putting her interests into practice by visiting poorhouses, asylums, and ragged schools. Statuesque and strong-featured, Princess May of Teck would have made the ideal wife for any socially concerned European prince or aristocrat if she had not been born of morganatic blood. The morganatic marriage, die morganatische Ehe, was an aristocratic Germanic device to prevent a nobleman or woman passing on their nobility to a spouse of lesser rank, so called because all that the lesser-born partner could receive from the marriage was the Morgengabe, the morning gift or dowry on the day after the wedding. It was social inequality enshrined in law, since the dowry might involve money, jewelry, or property, but carried no precedence or succession rights, thus preserving the purity of the family title, while also consigning the morganatic partner and their descendants to a permanently inferior social status. May's morganatic taint came from her grandfather, a duke who had married a mere countess, thus disqualifying his descendants from marriage into many of Europe's royal and noble families. Queen Victoria, however, had no time for such continental snobberies. She had watched May mature through all her misfortunes in Short Street, and she considered the earnest young woman, now 25, to be the ideally solid partner for her wayward grandson, Eddie, the elder son of the future King Edward VII, and thus a future heir to the throne. When flu carried off poor feckless Eddie in January 1892, on the eve of his marriage to May, the family were perhaps less inwardly broken-hearted than they outwardly appeared, and who better to pass on to May's care than the new heir in line, Eddie's younger and significantly less feckless brother George. The young man duly proposed and was accepted, and the couple were married in the Chapel Royal St. James's on the 6th of July 1893. This more than semi-arranged marriage of Georgie and May, they became George and Mary on his accession to the throne in 1910, produced a strong emotional bond, particularly under the strains of the war that the king took so personally. "Very often I feel in despair," he wrote in one of the daily letters that he and his wife exchanged when their war duties took them apart. "And if it wasn't for you, I should break." Mary responded warmly, but with regretful rebuke at her husband's face-to-face formality. "What a pity it is," she replied, "that you cannot tell me what you write, for I should appreciate it so enormously." 44 years old when he came to the throne, George V had spent much of his youth as a naval officer, and his stiff, quarter-deck upper lip was part of his style. Having sent his eldest son David to the Western Front, the king dispatched his second son Bertie to a succession of postings on naval warships, where the young midshipman, checked off daily as Mr. Johnson on the ship's roll call, learned to shovel coal, sling his hammock in the communal mess room, and eventually saw action in a gun turret at the Battle of Jutland in the summer of 1916. In London, Queen Mary was seeking to fashion her own response to the appalling toll of war. Jutland had seen 6,000 British deaths in a single battle. 57,470 had died on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, 1st of July, more than had been killed in the Crimean and Boer Wars put together. That August, colourful street shrines started appearing on the brick walls of terrace houses in the East End of London, folk memorials created by locals to honour those from the neighbourhood who had lost their lives. The names of the local casualties were framed by flags, flowers and ribbons, as well as by pictures of military leaders and members of the royal family. When Queen Mary appeared in Hackney that August, walking quite informally and with no obvious security from shrine to shrine, huge crowds gathered to cheer. The Queen bowed her head and laid a posy beside each of the 10 rolls of honour, talking at length to those who had gathered in grieving. Men and women wept openly. It was difficult to imagine any princess of Germany, Austria, or Russia getting such a warm and welcoming response from their people, if indeed any of them would have dreamed of mingling with their subjects in the street. But events in faraway St. Petersburg changed the tone. "Bad news from Russia," noted George V in his diary on the 13th of March 1917. "Practically a revolution has broken out in Petrograd." 2 days later came the news that his cousin Nicky, Tsar Nicholas II, had been compelled to abdicate. "I am in despair." The Russian Revolution struck a chill into monarchies all over Europe. Within 18 months, two other emperors had vanished, along with 8 ruling sovereigns, all victims of military defeat, and even the monarchies of victorious countries felt the difference. "I have noticed, since the news came to hand of the Russian Revolution," noted Colonel Unsworth, a Salvation Army officer from Essex, "a change has come over a certain sector of the people in respect to their attitude towards the king and the royal family. In the streets, trains and buses, one hears talk. A friend of mine saw written in a second-class railway carriage, 'To hell with the king, down with all royalties.'" Railway second-class carriages were the equivalent of business class in aeroplanes today. So, Unsworth was wondering, might the slogans in the third-class carriages be even more disloyal? In June 1917, George V's financial adviser, Lord Revelstoke, wrote to the King's private secretary, Lord Stamfordham, suggesting that the King should be better briefed on the anti-monarchical and republican sentiment in the country, to the indignation of the private secretary. "I can unhesitatingly say," he responded, "that I do not believe there is any sovereign in the world to whom the truth is more fearlessly told by those in his immediate service, and who receives it with such goodwill and even gratitude as King George. There is no socialist newspaper, no libelous rag, that is not read and marked and shown to the King if they contain any criticisms, friendly or unfriendly, of His Majesty and the Royal Family." The truth of Stamfordham's claim resides today in the Royal Archives, in a file entitled Unrest in the Country. Inside are the carefully marked articles from radical publications, and the project went beyond clippings. Stamfordham assembled a floating brains trust of experts who were felt to have their fingers on the pulse of the country. Part intelligence network, part think tank, their deliberations and reports are also included in the files. One such gathering took place at the end of April 1917, when the chief talking point was an inflammatory letter that the novelist H.G. Wells had sent to the Times, calling for the creation of a Republican Society for Great Britain, designed to show that our spirit is warmly and entirely against the dynastic system that has so long divided, embittered, and wasted the spirit of mankind. In a much-quoted exchange, Wells had made no secret of his contempt for George V's alien and uninspiring court, to which the King had famously retorted, "I may be uninspiring, but I'll be damned if I'm an alien." The word alien hit a particularly sensitive spot in the spring of 1917. The Zeppelin airships that had erratically bombed East Anglia and Sandringham in 1915, creating Wolferton Splash, had been supplemented by a far more formidable threat: heavily armed German battle plane bombers, manufactured by the Gothaer Waggonfabrik factory that was located, of all places, in Goethe, the southern section of the duchy from which the British ruling family took their name. The first Goethe bombing raid killed 95 people in and around Folkestone on the south coast in Kent, with a June raid on London killing 162, and in the next 16 months, Goethe battle planes would carry out a total of 22 raids on England, dropping 186,830 pounds of explosives. But the numbers were less important than the popular bewilderment that this dreadful destruction should be raining down from enemy aircraft that bore part of the King's family name. The issue of the royal family's Teutonic origins and links had been on the agenda since the beginning of the war, when Dicky Mountbatten's father, Prince Louis of Battenberg, had been hounded from the Admiralty by the witch hunt against all things Germanic. But with the arrival over London of the Goethe battle planes, the issue became serious, and Stamfordham discussed the problem with another member of the Unrest in the Country think tank, the former Prime Minister, Lord Rosebery. In a letter of the 15th of May, Stamfordham had come up with an idea of an English surname, Tudor Stuart was his suggestion, that could be used by the entire royal family, Battenbergs and Tecks included. At a meeting 2 days later, Rosebery suggested Fitzroy, and over the weeks that followed, Plantagenet, York, Lancaster, and even England were canvassed. After some discussion, the Tecks, Queen Mary's family, and Battenbergs chose to go their own way, the Battenbergs becoming Mountbatten, while the Tecks became Cambridge, leaving Stamfordham with the dilemma of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. Pondering all the alternatives one day, he was said to have been looking out of the window at the famous Round Tower at the time, the private secretary hit upon Windsor. It clicked immediately. "Do you realise," Rosebery congratulated him, "that you have christened a dynasty?" It was an extraordinary leap of imagination. Just saying the word Windsor conjured up the benevolent solidity of the stone round tower rising on the mound first built beside the Thames by William the Conqueror. No monarchy in history had done as such before. Newcomers and usurpers had taken over old names. But for an ancient clan coolly to reinvent itself with a fresh identity plucked from the air reflected hard-eyed realism, plus a certain measure of fear. On the 17th of July, the Privy Council announced the change, along with the royal family's renunciation of all German degrees, styles, dignitaries, titles, honours, and appellations. A new dynasty had been created to meet public demand. The decree gave no explanation for the reinvention, but the reason was obvious and would become the guiding principle of the new House of Windsor: survival at any price. In Germany, the Kaiser remarked that he was looking forward to the next performance of The Merry Wives of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha. George V, Queen Mary, and their unrest-in-the-country advisers had understood the changes that mass industrialization had wrought. The still feudal monarchies of Germany, Austria, and Russia, with their morganatic marriages and class-based barriers, saw themselves as the summit of a social pyramid in which the monarchy stood on the shoulders of the nobility, below whom were stacked the merchant middle classes, with the common people below that. Hierarchy mattered. It was Stamfordham's analysis, and the instinct of the king and queen, that hierarchy was out of date. They had the same vision, in fact, as Karl Marx, that power in the modern world lay at the true foundation of the pyramid, with the people. "Are we going to keep the king?" a left-wing activist had asked at a socialist summer camp in 1913. "Of course we are," came the answer, displaying the wobbly logic of which both socialists and monarchists are capable. "In England, the king does what the people want. He will be a socialist king." A still more emphatic answer came at the Labour Party conference a few years after the war in 1923, when votes were invited on the proposition that the royal family is no longer necessary as part of the British constitution. 386,000 votes supported the motion. 3,694,000 voted against. General affection for the monarchy survived across Britain through the 1920s and 1930s, little shaken by the hardships of the Great Depression. And on the 6th of May 1935, the silver jubilee of George V's 25 years on the throne was marked by celebrations all over the country. A spectacular panoramic oil painting by Frank Salisbury of the royal family entering St. Paul's Cathedral for the service of thanks presented the latest iconography of the Royal House of Windsor, which featured by that date the little princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret Rose. The girls were taken out on the balcony of Buckingham Palace at the end of that day for their first experience of the crowd surging and cheering in their thousands against the palace railings, in spontaneous acclamations that swelled up every night for the rest of the following week.
"I had no idea they felt like that about me," declared the 69-year-old king. "I'm beginning to think they must really like me for myself."
This was the history that fueled the outrage of the 84-year-old Queen Mary early in February 1952, when Ernst August of Hanover brought her the news of Louis Mountbatten's toast down at Broadlands to the new reigning House of Mountbatten. She angrily summoned Jock Colville, Churchill's private secretary, to take instant action, and the Prime Minister responded at a cabinet meeting that same day. Churchill shared the old Queen's historical memories and indignation. There were war criminals and German finance contributions to discuss, but to the very top of the agenda for the 18th of February 1952 went Name of the Royal Family. The Cabinet's attention was drawn to reports that some change might be made in the family name of the Queen's children and their descendants, read the Cabinet minutes. The Cabinet was strongly of the opinion that the family name of Windsor should be retained, and they invited the Prime Minister to take a suitable opportunity of making their views known to Her Majesty. Within 2 days, Churchill had passed on the government's unanimous verdict to the Queen, provoking a domestic explosion.
Philip was deeply wounded,
recalled his naval comrade Mike Parker 50 years later, still shaking his head at the memory of the ructions that ensued.
I'm just a bloody amoeba, the injured husband famously complained. I'm the only man in the country not allowed to give his name to his children.
Philip sat down immediately to write a paper arguing his case, and also suggesting a compromise, that his children might take the name of Edinburgh, and that the royal house might now be known as the House of Windsor and Edinburgh. Churchill was unimpressed. In fact, he flew into a rage when presented with the paper. He instructed the Lord Chancellor, the Lord Privy Seal, the Home Secretary and the Leader of the House of Commons, the biggest legal guns in his government, to spend 2 long meetings with Colville, stamping every breath of life out of Philip's proposals. The grievance would rumble on for years. The Conservative politician R.A. Butler later said that the only time he saw the normally equable Elizabeth II close to tears was when confronted by the troubled issue of the family surname. But in the short term, the issue was settled by a proclamation of the 7th of April 1952, declaring the Queen's will and pleasure that I and my children shall be styled and known as the House and Family of Windsor, and that my descendants, other than female descendants who marry and their descendants, shall bear the name of Windsor. The proclamation had been prepared and taken to the Queen's study in Buckingham Palace by her private secretary, Tommy Lascelles, a confirmed pro-Windsor and anti-Mountbatten man. And as Elizabeth II bent her head to sign the document, he later related with grim satisfaction, he stood over her like one of the barons of Runnymede. Sir Alan Tommy Lascelles, 1887 to 1981, played by Pip Torrens.
He is the most attractive man I have ever met, declared Alan Tommy Lascelles, as he joined the staff of Edward, Prince of Wales, in 1921.
8 years later, Lascelles resigned in disgust at his master's incorrigible womanizing and neglect of his royal duties, and his sense of betrayal infused the rest of his career with a dark and holy anger. Lascelles fumed in his diary against Edward VIII as the most tragic might have been in history, and even when he located the principles that he valued in George VI and his daughter, he saw himself as more their tutor than their private secretary, 1943-52 to the king, 1952-53 to Elizabeth II. It was for Lascelles to teach them their job and enforce the Faustian bottom line of modern monarchy, that kings and queens must abide by the rules of conduct expected of them by those who put them there, since those who put them there are the people who pay for them. Queen Mary, 1867 to 1953, played by Eileen Atkins.
I played with Lilibet in the garden making sand pies,
wrote Queen Mary delightedly in her diary for the 14th of March, 1929.
The Archbishop of Canterbury came to see us and was so kind and sympathetic.
Less than 3 years old, the future Elizabeth II was already learning lessons from her grandmother, who, as co-founder with George V of the House of Windsor, helped develop the blend of grandeur with accessibility that lies at the heart of the modern popular monarchy. Queen Mary taught her granddaughter the value of an upright posture, the helpfulness of high heels and fancy hats for a lady of limited stature, and the overarching importance of putting crown before self. She also passed on a special Windsor trick for dealing with over-intimate remarks and presumptuous questions, to keep smiling levelly at the perpetrator as if you are hearing absolutely nothing, then move on smartly. The Duke and the Crybaby.
What a smug, stinking lot my relations are. You've never seen such a seedy, worn-out bunch of old hags.
Whenever family business brought him to London, the exiled Duke of Windsor liked to let his feelings rip, and in February 1952 the notes that he wrote to his wife about the funeral of his brother George VI were especially direct.
Cookie and Margaret feel most.
Cookie was the couple's nickname for Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother.
Mama, Queen Mary, as hard as nails, but failing. When queens fail, they make less sense than others in the same state. Mountbatten. One can't pin much on him, but he's very bossy and never stops talking. All are suspicious and watching his influence on Philip. The ex-king's only kind words were for his niece, the new queen, Shirley Temple, in the Windsor Code, who invited him to lunch with her husband in Clarence House. Informal and friendly, brave new world, full of self-confidence, and seemed to take the job in their stride. In episode 3 of The Crown, Peter Morgan introduces the former King Edward VIII to the drama, starting with a flashback to his abdication in December 1936. A few hours ago, I discharged my last duty as king and emperor. While we watched the little princesses play unsuspectingly with their corgis and bicycles. Later in the episode, we follow the Duke, played by Alex Jennings, as he arrives in London in February 1952, mingling his role at his brother's funeral with his manoeuvrings to save the £10,000 annual pension that George VI had been paying him while he was alive. We see the Duke triumph on screen at the end of the episode, working out a deal with Winston Churchill that also helps resolve the impasse over the royal family name. In reality, the Duke of Windsor did not retrieve his £10,000 pension. Cookie and Mama made sure of that. But the dynamics of the plot are based on an intriguing strand of history, that Edward VIII was an old friend of Winston Churchill, and that Churchill nearly destroyed his own political career when he took the king's side in 1936 and tried to save him from having to abdicate. The two men became close in the summer of 1919, when the 25-year-old prince was due to deliver a speech at a banquet for the victorious Allied war leaders after the First World War. The 34-year-old Churchill, Secretary of State for War and Air in Lloyd George's post-war coalition, sent the young man some speaking advice, that he should not feel ashamed to read out his speech, but that if he did go the written route, he should do it quite openly, doing it very slowly and deliberately. It would be better, of course, to memorize his text, or to speak with only glancing reference to notes. And in this event, Churchill recommended creating an improvised lectern from the table glassware and crockery, a finger bowl placed on top of a tumbler, with a plate on top of that as a mini platform for your notes. "But one has to be very careful," he warned, "not to knock it all over, as once happened to me." In the event, the young Prince of Wales committed his 1919 speech to memory and delivered it entirely without notes, to Churchill's approval. "You are absolutely right to take trouble with these things," he wrote. "With perseverance, you might speak as well as anybody in the land." As abdication loomed 15 years later, Churchill instinctively took the king's side. He was a royalist. "The last believer in the divine right of kings," as his wife Clementine once put it despairingly. He was also a romantic, defending Wallace Simpson, Edward VIII's much-reviled American sweetheart, to be as necessary to his happiness as the air he breathed. With pressure and publicity mounting in December 1936, the king turned to Churchill, long out of office but rebuilding his reputation through his sturdy opposition to German rearmament, and a founder member of Focus, a cross-party group that spoke out against fascism. Churchill's advice to the king was to play for time, hoping for some sort of solution short of abdication, a German-style morganatic marriage, perhaps, whereby Mrs. Simpson might become his wife but not his queen, renouncing royal status for herself or any children. This proposal received short shrift, not least from the Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin. "Is this the sort of thing I've stood for in public life?" he asked disgustedly. Ernest Bevin was even firmer on behalf of the Labour Party. "Our people won't have it," he said. On Friday the 4th of December, Churchill went to dine with Edward VIII in Fort Belvedere, the King's castellated residence near Sunningdale on the fringe of Windsor Great Park. The King must keep up his strength, Churchill insisted with emotion. He suggested the King must see a doctor, and that he should on no account go abroad. Above all, the king must play for time, and asked for as long as he needed to make up his mind.
"There is no force in this country," he declared, "which would or could deny it you."
Parliament would be debating the subject shortly, and Churchill felt confident that the so-called King's Party would prevail.
"Good advances on all fronts," he wrote to the King the following day,
claiming success with his lobbying activities.
There were prospects of gaining good positions and assembling large forces behind them.
But Churchill had gravely mistaken the mood of the country. That weekend, MPs canvassed opinion in their constituencies, and when they returned to Westminster on Monday, they strongly backed the intransigence of Baldwin and Bevin. The King could not have it both ways. He would have to renounce Mrs. Simpson if he wanted to keep the throne. When Churchill rose to his feet in the Commons on Tuesday to plead the King's cause, filled with emotion and brandy, according to one observer, he was brutally shouted down. The once-respected former minister begged his colleagues not to rush to judgment and to give the King more time, to be ridiculed by an overwhelmingly hostile House. "It was," wrote The Times the next day, "the most striking rebuff in modern parliamentary history." Robert Boothby, Churchill's loyal ally in his stand against Hitler, was devastated.
"In 5 fatal minutes," he wrote, "the Focus Crusade against appeasement had crashed into ruin."
Like Violet Bonham Carter and Churchill's other allies, Boothby was appalled by this latest Churchillian error in judgment.
"No one will deny Mr. Churchill's gifts," editorialized the Spectator gloatingly. "But a flair for doing the right thing at the right moment, or not doing the wrong thing at the wrong moment, is no part of them. He has utterly misjudged the temper of the country and the temper of the House, and the reputation, which he was beginning to shake off, of a wayward genius unserviceable in council, has settled firmly on his shoulders again."
Staggered by the unanimous rejection, Churchill shuffled out of the chamber, humiliated.
"What happened this afternoon," wrote Boothby in fury to his former hero, "makes me feel that it is almost impossible for those who are devoted to you personally to follow you blindly, as they would like to do in politics, because they cannot be sure where the hell they are going to be landed next."
In the days that followed, Churchill helped Edward VIII frame the eloquent words of the abdication speech that was now inevitable, and he also fought his friend's corner in the deeply bitter negotiations over the pension that George VI reluctantly agreed to pay his brother. It was hardly surprising that when Britain's desperate wartime situation eventually brought Churchill out of the wilderness, initially as First Lord of the Admiralty in 1939, and then into Downing Street in May 1940, George VI had his reservations.
"I cannot yet think of Winston as PM, he noted in his diary.
And Churchill ruefully described in his memoirs how he had been smitten in public opinion.
"It was the almost universal view that my political life was ended." "I have defended you so many times," says Churchill in Episode 3 to the Duke of Windsor, "each time to my cost and in vain."
There was much to recall when Churchill and the Duke of Windsor met again in London in the run-up to George VI's funeral in February 1952, and the tears welled up in the old Prime Minister's eyes.
"Nobody cried in my presence," the Duke reported home to Wallace, "only Winston, as usual,"
prompting the Duke and his wife to devise and bestow another of their clever nicknames upon the great war hero, Crybaby, which said more about them than it did about him. After a few glasses of brandy, the Duke liked to deliver an after-dinner parody of the Fort Belvedere meeting when Churchill had pleaded with him not to abdicate, complete with a spoofed-up Churchillian accent.
"Sir, we must fight."
As Tommy Lascelles wrote sadly in 1944, Churchill's sentimental loyalty to the Duke was based on a tragic false premise, viz. That he, Winston, really knew the DFW, which he never did. Clarence House, 1952. Clarence House is tacked onto the side of St. James's Palace, like a brightly iced Christmas cake. Designed and built by John Nash, the architect of Regency London, the white stuccoed mansion was the home of the Duke of Clarence, who later became King William IV, 1830 to 1837. And it has traditionally been the perch of retired royals or of royals-in-waiting. Queen Elizabeth the Queen Mother lived there for nearly half a century until her death in 2002, to be succeeded by Prince Charles as he restarted his married life with his new wife Camilla. But early in 1952, Clarence House seemed destined for a higher purpose, as the principal home base of Queen Elizabeth II and her young family, a new perch for a new monarch, with the huge royal standard fluttering overhead.
"Thank you for all this," says Elizabeth at the opening of Episode 3 of The Crown, looking appreciatively around the renovations that her husband has been supervising. "It looks splendid."
"This is the first proper home I've ever had," responds Philip contentedly, leaning down to kiss his wife's cheek as the family breadwinner sets off on her daily commute to Buckingham Palace, no longer a royal residence, just a very grand office.
Lacking a single modern bathroom or a proper electrical system when the royal couple first inspected it in October 1947, Clarence House had emerged from the war in a mournfully derelict state, with bomb-damaged ceilings and a leaking roof. Lighting was provided by surface wiring on cleats tacked onto the wall by the Red Cross, the principal occupants after 1942, along with a temporary department of 200 Foreign Office civil servants concerned with the welfare of British prisoners of war. Parliament voted £50,000 for restoration, despite protests that the money could be better spent on public housing, and the work was completed in a speedy 18 months, and a cost overrun of £28,000, with Elizabeth and Philip visiting as often as twice a day. Elizabeth helped to mix the soft Edinburgh green shade of paint for the dining room.
"Put a bucket of hay in there," she said when someone complained about the smell, "and that'll take it away."
While Philip delighted in bringing back gadgets and labour-saving devices from the Ideal Home exhibition, his office boasted the latest intercom, telephones and switchboard, along with a fridge for cold drinks, while his wardrobes could magically eject any uniform or shirt he wanted at the press of a button. The young Duke had picked up many of his ideas from his gadget-crazy uncle, Dicky Mountbatten, though he did not go in for the latter's ultimate time-saving contrivance, a simplex shirt with built-in Y-fronts. The Duke developed an unconventional reputation among the 11 staff, each of whom had their own carpeted bedroom and radio, and a sleek white, very futuristic television set in the servants' hall, a wedding present from the Mountbattens. Word circulated that their boss did not own a single pair of pyjamas.
"Never wear the things," he said to one valet, while another reported him totally unembarrassed to be discovered one morning naked in bed with the princess, who always wore a silk nightgown.
Sir Frederick Boy Browning, treasurer of the Duke's household, tracked the Duke down to the palace pool across the road one day to find Philip giving his children swimming lessons, stark naked. The Clarence House emphasis was on informality. Light, serve-yourself lunches in the relaxed style that had impressed the Duke of Windsor on his 1952 visit, with casual dishes such as bangers and mash for supper. "They almost lived like ordinary people," recalled John Gibson, the nursery footman in charge of polishing and pushing Prince Charles's pram. "A lot less formal than some people I came across, people much further down the social scale." Both Elizabeth and Philip loved playing with their children in the extensive garden that Clarence House shared with St. James's Palace. As the couple confronted the unexpected challenge of taking up their new royal duties in February 1952, both of them were attracted by the prospect of continuing to operate from their purpose-designed and cosy home base, defying tradition and the expectation of the royal establishment that they would move down the road to the grandeur of Buckingham Palace. Philip and Elizabeth decided that they did not, in fact, want to live above the shop. Staying in Clarence House would avoid the disruption of a move, and Philip, so happy in the up-to-date setting he had worked so hard to fashion, had developed a particular aversion to the cold formality of the palace,
headquarters of what younger courtiers called the Old Codgers, headed by Tommy Lascelles, whose disapproval he could sense. As a precedent, the very first occupant of Clarence House had continued living there after he became King William IV in 1830, strolling to work every morning next door in St. James's Palace. Philip set out his case in one of his naval-style position papers with the full support of his wife, and he was able to cite an unexpected ally. Queen Elizabeth, now the Queen Mother, was most reluctant to move out of her long-established quarters in the palace, and her son-in-law developed this into a longer-term proposition. Looking only 20 years or so into the future, he argued, Prince Charles would require his own residence as Prince of Wales. As the annex to St. James's Palace, where so many subsidiary royal gatherings took place, Clarence House was the ideal HQ for the heir to the throne. It would be blocked if the lively and youthful Queen Mother were to be installed there, and that turned out to be precisely what came to pass. Thanks to the Queen Mother's longevity, Prince Charles had to set himself up as a young man in the comparative remoteness of Kensington Palace, and did not move into the St. James's Palace complex until 2003, when he was well into his 50s. But Philip's pleadings cut no ice with Lascelles and the Old Codgers, who were emphatically supported by Winston Churchill. Buckingham Palace was the long-established focus of royal and national sentiment, insisted the Prime Minister, and the monarch had no choice but to live there. Elizabeth, Philip, and their children went off to Windsor for their Easter holidays early in April 1952, and when they returned to London, it was to move into Buckingham Palace, only a few days after the proclamation that had affirmed the enduring primacy of the House of Windsor. In the course of a few months, the Duke of Edinburgh had lost three of his young life's most cherished components, his naval career, his family home, and his family name. It did not make for a happy husband. Chapter 4. Act of God. The Great Smog of 1952. On the face of it, there is as much invention as history in Episode 4 of The Crown, Act of God. The principal catalyst in this episode, Venetia Scott, Winston Churchill's attractive young secretary who gets killed by a bus, never existed. In the early days of December 1952, the Great Smog was not experienced as a life-and-death crisis by Londoners long inured to the routine of their winter pea soupers. Nor did Clement Attlee and the Labour Party seek to bring down the Churchill government for its handling of the issue. On the other hand, the heroic Venetia Scott is a carefully researched, true-to-life-and-spirit composite of the remarkable team of women who worked so devotedly for Churchill in Downing Street. The Great Smog, the word was a combination of smoke and fog first coined by newspapers in Edwardian times, did eventually prove the catalyst for Britain's first clean air legislation. And as for Labour not attacking Churchill more strongly, they didn't need to. The ageing leader was undermined by the treachery of some of his own closest cabinet colleagues. Marion Holmes was the youngest of Churchill's secretaries, 22, fair-haired and blue-eyed, according to one of her Downing Street colleagues, like a fairy, the most obvious physical model for Venetia Scott.
"That's a damn pretty girl. Lovely," Churchill once remarked to his guests at Chequers, the country residence of British Prime Ministers, while Marion was out of the room fetching a whiskey and soda. "The sort of girl who'd rather die than have the secrets torn out of her." "Oh dear, she's very young," he said on another occasion to his wife, Clementine. "I mustn't frighten her." Fully aware of the knee-quaking effect that his tantrums could have on others, the irascible Prime Minister tried to adopt a paternal attitude towards the team of half a dozen or more young women who made up his typing pool. Working on a continuous shift and relay system, his secretaries would take his dictation from 8:30 in the morning while he was having his breakfast, usually in bed, until well after midnight and into the small hours, often in his dressing gown. "You must never be frightened of me when I snap," he once told Marion Holmes. "I'm not thinking of you, I'm thinking of the work."
Holmes found that Churchill might suddenly go silent, then launch into a long strand of dictation without any warning, unaware of everything and everyone around him as he stalked up and down. He might sound out one tricky phrase to himself as many as 20 times sotto voce, going around and around with it until he got it right, often with the help of a glass of brandy or his beloved Paul Roger champagne.
"You can't make a good speechwriter on iced water," he used to say.
Whenever the Prime Minister cleared his throat, his secretaries knew they had to get their pencils out and start scribbling their shorthand. They might easily get through an entire notebook in a single session, or else locate one of the so-called silent typewriters that was always nearby and try to type out the words as they flowed. When Churchill returned to Downing Street in 1952, he moved his bedroom upstairs and reserved the room across the hall for his personal secretaries.
"Girl!"
he would shout from his bed, and one of them would come running with her pad and pencil at the ready.
"Give me,"
was his abrupt instruction when he considered the current document finished, and he would reach out to take the paper as it was peeled off the roller. After the briefest of breaks to look over the words, he would start dictating again. Phyllis Moyer, who joined Churchill's staff in 1932, was the first secretary to document the strange ordeal experienced by Venetia Scott in Episode 1, taking dictation while her boss splashed around in the bath. The dictating was always done with relative propriety, with the orator's tones being broadcast through a slightly open bathroom door. But occasionally the Prime Minister would stalk out into the corridor with a towel draped round his expansive midriff, still loudly declaiming the speech he was due to deliver somewhere that evening. Staff took it in their stride in Downing Street, but the rotund and dripping spectacle stalking down a corridor at full volume would scare the wits out of unsuspecting housemaids in country houses, according to Moyer, when Churchill went away for the weekend. During the war, his energies never seemed to relent, with dictation continuing full flow on some occasions until 4:30 in the morning. Working for Neville Chamberlain, Churchill's predecessor in No. 10, Marion Holmes had been accustomed to stopping work every day at 6 p.m. But when Churchill arrived in May 1940, she wrote in her diary, "It was as if a superhuman current of high-voltage electricity was let loose." The new PM seemed to relish the blizzard of official papers generated by any crisis, processing each document on the spot and sending it onwards, usually garnished with one of his specially printed red labels demanding, "Action this day."
"We must go on and on like gun horses till we drop," Churchill told Elizabeth Nell, who joined his staff in 1941 at the height of the Blitz.
"Fool, mug, and idiot" were some of the gentler words that the Prime Minister flung at Nell's head when she mistakenly typed her first memo single-spaced, not with the double spacing that no one had told her he preferred. If frustrated, Churchill would actually stamp his feet like a small child, but the recruit came to accept his frequent snaps as part of the grander project of which she was part.
"Good heavens,"
he once said to Nell when he